Back in 2006, just after Wallace retired from 60 Minutes, I got to talk with him upon the publication of the second volume of his memoirs. At the time, Wallace was 87 years old. Today, a week after Wallace's death at 93 years old and after last night's 60 Minutes piece, it seems an appropriate time to go back and listen to that 2006 conversation with Mike Wallace. Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff.
Delight to have you here. In this book, you recall countless interviews that you've had with the great, the near great, the famous, and the infamous. As you look back on all these interviews, how have these people impacted your view of the world? How many of them have changed the way you've thought about something or have sort of altered, perhaps, beliefs that you've held?
Well, you know something. When you put them all together, you suddenly realize what an opportunity I've had over the past half century and more to talk to all manner of whether they're politicians or con men or cultural icons or you name it. It's been just astonishing. I was at ABC back in 1957, and I had a chance to interview a woman, the widow of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Eleanor Roosevelt. Well, in retrospect, she was a worldwide figure. She was the eyes and ears, and it turned out also the legs for her husband, who had been four times elected president of the United States. How many other reporters have been fortunate enough to talk to a woman like that, mm-hmm. who had so much to do with the way that human rights developed in the United States, and through her, because she had so much influence on human rights around the world, particularly in other countries, that add to that, mm-hmm. in 1958, also on ABC at that time, Margaret Sanger. Well, Margaret Sanger was responsible for the development of the birth control pill. Birth control was a dirty word back then. And she was anxious to take on what she perceived as the hypocrisy of the Catholic Church back then, who were talking about the fact that you're supposed to, when you go to bed with your wife or whomever, you're supposed to do it to create children. And she was quite angry about that. As a result of what you can imagine, the furor that caused back in 1958, there's a fellow by the name of Clint Hill, who was the Secret Service guy who followed the JFK car, who then believed, because if he had just been there a half second sooner or a second sooner, he could have kept JFK from dying. And the anguish in that man, it was... anguish that translated, I still can't remember exactly how and why he was willing to sit down and talk about it. But he and his wife sat there, actually in the Madison Hotel in Washington some years later, to talk about the fact that he believed that he was responsible for the death of the president, and for a Secret Service man to feel that way. And then there are the lighter ones, uh-huh. for instance, Shirley MacLaine, who world-renowned actress, who talked with such candor about her lifestyle and the lifestyle that she had lived and intended to live, and you know, over the years, to be able to talk to all manner of people in that fashion, it's just the best job imaginable.
Did you have, when you talked to, did the interview with Clint Hill or Eleanor Roosevelt or some of these others that you were talking about, a sense of responsibility to history, a sense of responsibility to a larger historical context and understanding of these people?
No, I wish I could plead guilty. No, I was simply interested in these individuals, and I figured I am surrogate for the audience. The audience is interested or would be fascinated by some of these people. And I, luckily, I started late to the game as far as doing this sort of thing is concerned. I was a radio announcer in Grand Rapids, Michigan, to begin with, at $20 a week in 1939, having been turned down by the people at the station in Muskegon, Michigan, for whatever reason. And then, because I was nosy by nature and willing, it wasn't work. It was a joy to go to work every day. And then I did back in the 50s, a show called Nightbeat on a local television station in New York. And, you know, when you start out, you know this, Jeff.
Mm-hmm.
When you start out, all you want to do is make for some interesting talk and on the radio when you start out. And then that developed into Nightbeat, which was a local television show.
Tell us a little about Nightbeat and the way, the style that you have become renowned for, really how that evolved during those early days of Nightbeat.
The early days of Nightbeat were astonishing. Well, I was doing the 11 o'clock news on Channel 5 in New York City. And it was the first half-hour news show. Back in those days, if you were doing a news show, 15 minutes, that was it. But a guy with whom I worked, my partner Ted Yates, came up with the idea that, hey, why don't we, as long as we have an audience, and let's see if we can't make for some interesting talk beyond the newscast. And so we began to get all kinds of interesting people. And we had developed a style of, call it arrogant, if you will, call it abrasive sometimes, but trying to get to the bottom of things, trying to ask questions that the audience would like to ask for themselves if they had the chance. And all of a sudden, in New York sometimes, when something new happens, and this was new, suddenly, you know, you'd be walking down the street, and I was no longer as anonymous as I had been just doing the news. Give 'em hell, Mike. That's right. Go get 'em. That kind of talk. And it was an instant New York hit. And when New York, which is supposed to be a very tough town, but when they discover something new and fresh, they're a wonderful crowd who welcome things that are new.
When people said that to you, when people said "go get them," or you know, how did you respond to that? I mean, did you have?
I couldn't believe it to begin with. You know, you. I don't know how large an audience you have or how personal. This is in Napa.
Correct.
How personal they get with you. You know how satisfying that is. It really is. And so once you have that, then there's a responsibility to be, of course, to be responsible the responsibility to be objective if you can, and not editorialize. Ask questions that are perhaps impertinent. Ask questions that stir conversations in homes. You know from the response of the audience how important good, interesting, sometimes controversial talk can be.
Talk a little bit about how the impertinent question, pushing the envelope, really trying to get to the heart of people, which you have done, and how others of late, particularly in more contemporary times, have taken that and pushed the envelope further into this kind of what people refer to as a kind of gotcha journalism. And how it's been taken too far.
Well, when you say gotcha journalism, after a while, that's what people began to say about us. Back then, we did, and this was also what really focused attention on 60 Minutes, was that we would ambush people in trying to talk to people. Sometimes we would come upon them unawares. We would try to get them to talk to us, and they don't want to talk, and so you'd wait outside their office, and you'd have the camera rolling. And that became, for a while, it was very effective, because you caught people unawares, and sometimes their pudding came tumbling out despite their wish to evade. But that palled after a while. We were when we were starting out, we wanted to shed some light where light had not been shed before. But if you do it for drama, for heat rather than light, then little by little people are going to realize that it's phony.
Mm-hmm.
That all you're trying to do is create confrontation for confrontation's sake.
And that's really the fundamental difference, I suppose, as to where some have taken it today, that it's more for entertainment and shock value as opposed to informational value.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And you know what happens? You know why it happens? It's because of competition. It's because of the fact that, you know, back in those days, there were 3 or 4, conceivably 5 local television stations. Well, now there are 300 or 400 or 500 cable stations or whatever. And too often, the bad drives out the good. And by that I mean it's shock value, shouting.
The shock value that you're talking about, does it serve any purpose, do you think? I mean, those that
the shock value
is
in circulation. In circulation. When I say the bad drives out the good, what I mean is that the shock value, the infotainment, the shouting,
right,
the calling of names, you're not after light, you are after heat. And when you do that, in my estimation, you surely diminish the journalistic, if you will, purity. Purity is a wonderful word for it. I would like to believe the journalistic integrity of what you do.
Talk about it with respect to the entertainment interviews that you've done, people like and that are included in the book, included in Between You and Me, Johnny Carson and Shirley MacLaine and the Barbara Streisand interview, the value of entertainment journalism, if you will.
Well, look, these people, the people that you've just talked about, Carson, for instance, Carson decided he was going to do it with us. And then he thought to himself, no, I don't want to give up control. I'm not going to do this. And then he invited me to appear on his broadcast, which I did. And in the middle of it, I said, come on, John. Why? You were all set to go, and then you... What harm is going to come? And he said, when he finally said, okay, I'll do it with you. And then he said, in the course of doing it, look, I am comfortable when I am in control. And when I am in control is when I'm behind the desk there, and it's my broadcast, and I do it my way. And in the course of it, he began to talk about the pressures that entertainers on television, comedians, feel. I said to him, tell me something. When you do your monologue, do you ever go easy on somebody? Do you ever, you don't come after them as hard as you might otherwise? And he said, well, I'll give you an example. Maybe you're too young to remember all of this, but when Wilbur Wills, chairman of the House Appropriations Committee in Washington, got into a to-do with a woman by the name of Fanny Fox in the Tidal Basin in Washington, D.C., it turned out that he suffered from alcoholism. And that's how he got into that kind of trouble. And Johnny said, for instance, when I learned about that, I just wouldn't go after him anymore because he has trouble with booze, and what's the point of taking advantage of a person? I said, well, of course it takes one to know one. And immediately, cruel, oh, you're cruel, he said. But then he began to talk about it. And then he acknowledged the fact that he had trouble with booze and that his personality just changed with a snap of the fingers because he did not know how to handle liquor. Johnny didn't want to smoke. As you know, he died from lung cancer. Mm-hmm. And during the course of it, there's no doubt about it. He was addicted to it, just as Peter Jennings was addicted to smoking. And so he began. What I'm talking about is you get, if you're lucky enough or determined enough to really go after people about whom other people are curious, and you can somehow persuade them that they will have a chance to get their point of view fairly, objectively put on the air, and you do that often enough, suddenly on a national basis and even on an international basis, suddenly you realize that people, you don't have subpoena powers, so the way that you get them is because they know that on 60 Minutes, for instance, they were going to be treated objectively, maybe tough, but objectively, fairly, dispassionately. And of course, it's a wonderful way to, there's just not a better job, not a better opportunity for a reporter.
One of the things, and you touched on this earlier, that you bring to this, and there's a powerful sense of this in so many of these interviews, in you getting some of these people to open up, is your sense of interest, your sense of curiosity about them, about the world, about their ideas. Talk a little about that.
Well, look, what happens is this. When I really want to persuade somebody, who may not be maybe a little skeptical, maybe not all that anxious to come on and talk, what I do is I will sit with a yellow pad, and I've done this for years, and write out. I will read everything and see everything that individual has done that I can. And then I'll do classifications of the questions. Motivation, greed, fear, thing. And what happens is that by the time you sit down with that individual, they understand, hey, this guy has really taken a lot of care. He really is curious about me and what I'm thinking about and what my life is like and what my thoughts are, and as a result of which he figures, hey, he's done a lot of homework. He cares. So I'm going to help him. And I cannot tell you how often that, what I like to call the chemistry of confidentiality, appears, because they respect the work that you've done before you sit down with them.
What is the level, and what do you think of the quality of that kind of interviewing, that kind of conversation in television today?
My favorite interviewers are Cottle, Walters, Charlie Rose. Somehow, I mean, these people are prepared, they're curious, they're fair, they've done their homework. Now, Chris Matthews is another one. They take the job seriously. They enjoy immensely the opportunity that they've got. And that shows. And when it shows, then the audience gets brought along at the same time.
The enthusiasm is the curiosity is infectious.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Mike Wallace, his memoir is Between You and Me. Mike Wallace, I thank you so much for being with us.
Jeff Sheckman, I'm really... I've had a good time.
Well, I'm glad.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.